everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Thoughtful Thursday. Thoughtful Thursday is the day when you and I get to meet with an expert who expands our take on experiences and relationships in the world. Today's guest is no different. I am very pleased to introduce to you Dr. Elizabeth Sheff, who is the author of several books, including Stories from the Polycule. Dr. Sheff, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, Dr. Sheff, you are more than an author. Tell us more about the kinds of expertise that you have.
I am also an expert witness in custody cases involving sex and gender minorities, especially people involved in polyamory or BDSM. I am a relationship coach, an academic coach, and a blogger.
You are very busy.
Yes, it's true.
Okay, you said that you are an expert particularly in relationships that in custody issues that particularly involve polyamorous relationships, and then you said something else, and I'm not quite sure what you said.
BDSM,
which is what
used to be called just sadomasochism, but now they've broken it into three kind of subcategories: bondage and discipline, dominance and submission, and sadism and masochism. So the people in the community call it kink or kinky sex.
Okay. And so in a situation where there's a custody matter, tell me how that would come up.
Usually, there's three different ways that custody is challenged for sex and gender minorities, especially for polyamorists. It's the adult polyamorist's parents who are the most likely to challenge their custody. So someone gets involved in a poly family and their mother is really uncomfortable with it and feels like it's not a positive place for her grandchild to grow up. So she sometimes sues for custody, or their father, something like that.
Okay.
Or the second most common is an ex-spouse will, as part of the divorce proceedings or after a divorce, will sue for custody if they find out their ex-spouse is in polyamorous relationship.
Okay.
Very occasionally, it is the state or child protective services, but far more frequently, it is a current or former family member.
And
that sues for custody.
The title of your book, Stories from the Polycule. Polycule means what?
A polycule is a collection of polyamorous relationships, like a network or kind of a large extended family,
okay,
of people involved in polyamorous relationships with cross-pollination between the smaller groupings.
Okay. When you set out to write this book, what was your goal?
My goal for this book was to bring the poly folks their own voices alive. In my first book, The Polyamorists Next Door, I used quotes from their interviews. I interviewed 133 people in polyamorous families and did use their quotes, but that book was really in my voice because it was a much longer explanation of the research and my findings.
I see.
That second book, Stories from the Polycule, is really in their voice. All I did was organize it. I wrote my own selection in it as well, and I wrote the introduction. But I didn't, 90% of that book is stories written by the polyamorists themselves.
Okay. And tell us, who is there a difference between a polyamorous relationship and an open relationship?
I would say that open is the larger category and polyamory falls under open. Open just means some kind of consensual non-monogamy.
Okay.
And polyamory is a more specific version of that, in which people not only know about, but are also probably friends with, hang out with.
Okay.
Their partners' partners.
Now, when many folks think about a polyamorous relationship or an open relationship, which I think is how most people would define anything that encompasses more than two people, there's often this sense that there's something wrong with these people. They have intimacy issues. There's a whole bunch of stuff going on, but that this is not a healthy way to live your life. So talk to us about who engages in polyamorous relationships. Who are these folks?
Well, they do have healthy relationships, some of them. I wouldn't say that every single polyamorous relationship is healthy. Also, every single monogamous relationship.
Okay, Elizabeth, I got to stop you because the same thing is happening now. I'm gonna ask you the question again, and see if the miracle folks will cut us some slack. Okay, Elizabeth, Eli. I'm supposed to call you Eli. Just remember that. Oh well.
That's okay.
Dr. Sheff, who are the folks who engage in polyamorous relationships? What are they like?
They tend to be white, middle class or upper middle class, very highly educated, incredibly highly educated, people living in urban and suburban areas. Pardon me. Who have unconventional religious views pretty frequently, either no religious views at all, or are part of the lesser known kind of paganism or Unitarian Universalism, things like that. So they tend to be liberal people who have already kind of challenged social convention or questioned whether social convention is always correct. Just because everyone else does it that way, does it mean that they have to do it that way?
I wonder if you have said that they tend to be exceptionally highly educated. And this may be my bias, but it seems to me that a lot of times when folks spend years and years and years and years in school learning things, that they can really learn how to get up in their head and stay in their head. Would you say that these are folks who tend to be able to do that, and therefore it would make it easier for them to adopt this lifestyle, or am I completely off the mark?
I think maybe some of them certainly are very heady or intellectually oriented.
Okay.
But some of them are very grounded in their body.
Okay.
So I'm not exactly sure if they would say that they're more head-oriented.
Okay.
Certainly some of them. There's a lot of, in the folks that I interviewed, there were a lot of teachers and counselors and doctors and IT professionals. So those are all fairly intellectual jobs.
Yeah. All right. It's interesting. There is something called ethical polyamory, which, again, that seems like a contradiction almost in terms for perhaps the uninformed. What exactly does ethical polyamory mean?
I'm so sorry. There. I would say the ethical portion of it is that people are honest about it, they're communicating about it openly, and they're not hiding their relationships from other people, much in the way that cheating is not ethical.
Gotcha.
Because one person in the relationship thinks they're in a monogamous relationship. The other person in the relationship has agreed to a monogamous relationship, or at least not established non-monogamy. And that kind of clandestine lying and cheating is unethical,
okay,
especially for polyamorous folks who feel like, you know, you could have multiple partners and you could just be open about it. Why are you lying about it?
Gotcha. Okay. Are there particular rules that one would go by in a polyamorous relationship?
Everyone negotiates, everyone in polyamorous relationships negotiates their own rules. So the rules will vary from relationship to relationship. A few kind of standard guidelines are that whatever rules apply to one person in the relationship apply to everyone else. So that's different from kind of standard polygamy, in which a man gets multiple partners, but the women have to be monogamous with him.
I see.
So who gets multiple partners depends on gender. The different rules are different depending on if you're a man or a woman. In polyamory, generally the rules are the same, regardless of gender.
Okay.
Some other fairly standard rules are being honest and communicative about what's happening. So being straightforward, telling the truth, and being very careful about sexually transmitted infections is a fairly common rule. Using latex barriers for any kind of sex that could transmit bodily fluid is very standard.
Okay.
For poly.
So it's a given that you're going to engage in protected sex, almost a given that you're going to engage in protected sex, whereas very often in heterosexual relationships, not only is it not a given, but sometimes one of the partners has to really fight to engage in protected sex.
Absolutely. And research shows that in cheating relationships, there's less use of protected sex and more likelihood, significantly higher likelihood, for the transmission of sexually transmitted infections, whereas in consensual non-monogamy, people can talk about using protection and they can negotiate safer sex guidelines. So there's much lower rates of transmission in consensually non-monogamous relationships, ironically.
That is ironic because, you know, again, the uninformed would think that it would be quite the reverse. How do communities tend to respond if there's a polyamorous relationship in the midst of, I don't know, a pretty staid community? What do they do with it?
I would say they don't notice.
Okay.
Polyamory often flies under the radar. If you are out in public and you see a woman with two men sitting at a table in a restaurant having dinner, likely you might think, oh, there's a woman with her husband and her brother,
right,
or their friend or their employee or something. There's a million things you could think of before you think there's a woman with her husband and her boyfriend.
Right. That's very true. And with children, do children have, I mean, you mentioned being an expert witness a lot of times in custody matters. Do children themselves have difficulties growing up in a polyamorous household?
Certainly some do. In research, I had expected to hear more about the difficulties from the children, and they do identify some difficulties, but the children were quite optimistic about the relationship style and on the whole felt that it was really beneficial for their lives to have these extra adults around to give them rides and give them advice and help with their homework. When the children did identify disadvantages, which they did, I asked everyone that I interviewed what were the advantages and what were the disadvantages. I had totally expected the kids to say that the biggest disadvantage was that their parents would get close to someone, the kids would develop a relationship with them, and then that person would leave, and the children would feel bereft or very sad that that adult companion had left. And they certainly mentioned that, and that was a problem for some of them, but a minor issue. The much greater issue for the kids was that there was way too much supervision in a polyamorous household. They couldn't get away with anything because there were always adults around and the adults would talk to each other. So if the kids said one thing to one adult, they had to remember and tell the same story to every single adult, or the adults would notice the inconsistency. So not being able to get away with anything, and bathroom crowding. The children didn't like that, especially the teen girls wanted their own bathroom.
It's interesting how children take in the world in which they live. Do these children tend to grow up and then have their own polyamorous relationships, or not?
Some of them do, and some of them don't. Because I did the research for 15 years, it was a longitudinal study, I was able to observe some of the children growing up and becoming polyamorous themselves. Some of them grew up and became monogamous. The ones that were still children, when I interviewed them, I would, if they were tweens or teens, I would ask them if they thought they would be polyamorous when they grew up. I didn't ask the small children, like the elementary school children. It just didn't seem like they would have a conception of that yet. But the middle school and high school children, I would ask. And some of them said, oh, definitely, absolutely, without question, going to be polyamorous. Some of them said, absolutely not, under no conditions would they ever be polyamorous, definitely not doing it. Most of them said, I don't know, I'm still even figuring out how to kiss someone. Whether or not I'm going to be polyamorous is way too big of a question for right now. You know, like they were 14 and they were just figuring things out, and polyamory was just way too, that was a thing for adults. They didn't even want to try to take a stab at it yet.
Children can be more wise than we give them credit for sometimes.
Yeah.
Dr. Sheff, let's talk about Zach. Zach is an interesting kind of fellow who you write about, and he articulates several lessons that he learns. Perhaps the most stunning one for him was the reality that there was such a thing as a polyamorous relationship in which one could engage. Tell us about Zach.
A lot of people are not necessarily aware of polyamory until they either hear about it on the media somehow, or especially find it online. And I call that the polyamorous possibility, or becoming aware that polyamory is an option, that you can have non-monogamous relationships openly instead of cheating, and you can negotiate ethical non-monogamy. Lots of people in this culture that we talk about monogamy as the right way to be, but we don't really do it very much. Some people certainly maintain monogamous relationships. But if you look at statistics about degree number of partners across a lifespan and incidents of infidelity, we don't necessarily practice monogamy, at least not to the degree that we talk about it. So a lot of people feel kind of stuck, that they're either being monogamous or they're cheating or they're single. And for people to realize that there is another option sometimes just blows their minds. So Zach realizes the polyamorous possibility by meeting someone in a polyamorous relationship and falling for them and realizing, oh, this is an option. Do I want to do this or not? Simply becoming aware of polyamory doesn't mean you have to do it.
Right.
Some people choose it. Some people don't. Some people are completely freaked out by it and don't want to hear or talk about it anymore. And some people are just like, huh, polyamory, maybe, maybe not, or not for me, you know, and don't get that freaked out by it.
One of the interesting lessons that Zach talked about learning was the lesson that pressure to be everything to someone is lifted. And I thought that was a really interesting take. I mean, certainly in the, you know, the monogamous relationships, so often the wisdom is repeated that you can't just be everything to one person. But a lot of times people expect that and they really want that and feel almost betrayed if they don't have that kind of connection. Whereas what Zach is saying is, you know what, I don't even have to go there.
Right, and that's a huge relief for a lot of people who realize that they don't have to either squash their own needs down and get them unmet, or that they don't have to meet all of their partner's needs, that other people can meet some of their partner's needs as well.
So does jealousy come into play in these kinds of relationships?
Absolutely. In almost, I was going to say every relationship I'm aware of, but some of them actually operate without jealousy. But those tend to be the longer term polyamorists who've been doing it for a long time and are in stable, committed relationships for decades. They don't tend to have to deal with jealousy a lot, but especially at first, when people are figuring out how to manage the new relationship, there's a lot of jealousy. And polyamorists learn to expect it, anticipate it, and plan for it and strategize around how to manage it.
How do you plan for that? How do you plan for your partner getting really undone if you go out on a date with somebody else? And your partner's agreed, but still completely undone when you get back to your partner. How do you deal with that?
Well, people anticipate it, that if they're going to be out on a date, then the partner who's not on the date, there's a few things they should do. For one thing, talk about it beforehand and get some reassurances from the partner who's going out on the date. Get some loving, get some affection, get some attention, some reassurances that that person still loves you, still wants to be with you. Also, during the date, instead of sitting alone at home and stewing about, I wonder what they're doing now, and what are they doing now, and where are they now, go distract yourself. Go do something fun. You can go out on your own date. You can go out with friends. You can plan a social event, you know, game night with the girls. Or do something, you know, you don't have to be with other people. You can also do something fun to distract yourself. Make yourself your favorite food. Take a bubble bath. You know, hog the covers. Something that helps you feel not just totally distracted with what the person is doing. and engaged in your own experience in the moment.
And
then when they get home, be sure to reconnect. Talk about how things went. Talk about how you're feeling. Get more reassurance, affection, and cuddling. And face the reasons. What's underlying the jealousy is also an important element. Often jealousy is a symptom of insecurity or fear or anger or something else happening underneath that emotion. So if you uncover the deeper emotion and face it directly, that can also help to diffuse jealousy.
I would think that if one or more of the partners just really found that they could not manage their own feelings when one of the family was out on a date, that that would suggest that polyamory is not the lifestyle for them.
I would say that polyamory is not the lifestyle for most people.
Okay.
In fact, that it's a very challenging and intensive relationship style, and it works great for some people, but I would say that's the minority of people. I would say the majority of people in my research and just in talking to people in the world, what most people actually want is as many lovers as they feel drawn to, but they want those lovers to be monogamous with them. Really, everybody kind of wants a harem, their own harem. And sharing them with other people is challenging. So I would say for the majority of people, either serial monogamy or something less emotionally intensive than polyamory that provides some sexual openness, but not the expectation that everyone will be kind of eventually become family members or fall in love with each other or establish these long-term, ongoing, emotionally intimate relationships. So things like swinging or being monogamish, meaning a monogamous couple allows each other a little bit of wiggle room in dealing with other people sexually, but are primarily monogamous. I think those styles of open relationship are much more workable for most people.
Monogamish. What exactly is monogamish?
So monogamish is when there is a couple, an identified couple, who are deeply committed to each other, but want to allow each other to, for instance, have a fling when they're traveling out of town, if they go out of town to a conference or something. And, you know, there's one person who's gone, you know, somebody lives in San Francisco, but they're in Seattle for the weekend, and they meet someone at their roofers conference, and they have a little fling. That doesn't have to be the end of the home relationship, or that they can, you know, hook up with their ex occasionally, or make out with someone on the dance floor. But the intent behind monogamous relationships is not to build an extended family of additional partners or multiple spouses, but to stay in the couple relationship, the two-person relationship with allowed dalliances on the side.
So that kind of sounds like what folks euphemistically refer to as friends with benefits.
Yes, yes. So you have the loving relationship between the couple and friends with benefits on the side. And it really varies by relationship. So some monogamish people will allow each other to flirt with other people online and things like that, but not actually meet them in person, or will allow each other to, you know, kind of hook up with other people but not have penetrative sex or something. So it really varies what kinds of benefits, I guess, you get from that friend. Vary a lot by the relationship.
Okay. But it sounds as though one of the keys to actually actively intentionally engaging in polyamorous relationships is that there is a loving, full, committed relationship to each member of the unit. It's not just about sex. It's about actually pulling them in to be part of a family.
For many people, yes. Especially in theory. In theory, polyamory is about the love and the emotional connection. And swinging is all about the sex. But in practice, the gray area between the two is very mushy. That some polys are more sex-focused, and some swingers are more emotion-focused. Ken Haslam, who is a polyamorous activist, came up with the word swally to describe that kind of gray area between swinging and poly. Swally.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, he's really funny. He's a great guy.
Now, you mentioned activists. Are there many activists, would you say, involved in supporting or promoting polyamorous lifestyles?
Absolutely. There is a community of people and all sorts of, I would say, multiple different communities. I made it sound like there was just one, actually, but there's quite a few different little sub-communities, some with local leaders, and then there are some national leader makes it sound so official, like there's an organization that elected leaders or something, and it's not at all like that. It's
okay.
Kind of people who've become known over time for writing books or going on speaking tours or leading groups or organizations. So Ken Haslam, the guy I mentioned at first, he organized poly geezers, or older people in poly relationships. Poly geezers.
Interesting. Is there, I mean, we're talking about poly activism, if you will. Would you say that there is an absolute need for it? Would the world be different without poly activists really advocating their views and their lifestyles?
I think and sex and gender minorities in general to be free from social attack. And that's where the activists come in. I don't think the activists need to proselytize about polyamory in the way that they encourage or recruit other people to become polyamorous. I don't think that is important at all.
Okay.
But for the people who are polyamorous, I think the need for activism comes when, if other people are uncomfortable with their relationship, people in monogamous relationships are uncomfortable, or cheaters are uncomfortable with the polyamory. Right now, there are no legal protections for polyamorous relationships. So you can lose your job, you can lose your children, you can lose your housing, and that's where I see the need for polyactivism, is to protect people's rights and liberty rather than recruit.
So are you saying that one could actually be fired or be put out of their home because they are living in a polyamorous relationship?
Absolutely, without question. So there's a number of companies that have in their employment contracts, they have things called morality clauses. And usually a morality clause will cover things like drug trafficking or embezzling, things like that. But sometimes it also covers family style. So it will prohibit adultery, for instance, and or it might prohibit bigamy. And so polyamorists are sometimes snared in that. So, for instance, if you are a manager for Chick-fil-A and you are discovered to be polyamorous, they absolutely will fire you. Or Hobby Lobby, some kind of more conservative organization or company. And if it's in the employment contract, it's fully legal. They can absolutely do that. In terms of housing, some municipalities, cities, or localities have rules against
Elizabeth,
too many.
Elizabeth, I have to interrupt you because I'm losing you again. So I'm going to ask you to start from in housing and just continue on with what you were saying.
Again?
Yeah.
Okay, I have a little fog in my throat, so I'm going to take a sip of this coffee first before I start.
You are permitted.
There. Sorry, my voice is kind of deep anyway, and I know it's just super deep this morning, so I hope it's coming across okay.
It's coming across fine when the gods aren't messing with us. All right, so you're going to pick up with in housing.
In housing, some localities or cities have specific rules that prohibit too many people who are unrelated, too many adults who are unrelated from living together, and what counts as too many varies. But often it's three or more people who are over 18 but are not married and are not biologically related. And usually those rules are written to keep out, for instance, sorority or fraternity houses, or designed to keep immigrants from sharing apartments. So sometimes people will come from other nations and then share housing to save money. Those are the inception, generally, of those rules. But landlords can use them and have used them against people in polyamorous relationships that have multiple adults who are not married or not biologically related, sharing the same household. You could be evicted, basically.
That's just kind of seems extraordinary, but as you name the large companies that have the kind of policies that can and have enacted on these kinds of behaviors, it seems not quite so surprising at all. Are there other large companies or companies that people would be aware of who have similar guidelines as Chick-fil-A and Hobby Lobby?
Those are the two that I'm primarily aware of. I'm sure there are others. And when negotiating an employment contract, the employer can, within legal limits, put whatever they want in there. I mean, they can't say, and you are required to have sex with me or something. That can't be a condition of employment. But in at-will employment states, they can fire you for whatever they want. So, for instance, in Georgia, it's a right to work state, meaning there's no protection against being fired. If your employer wants to fire you, they can.
For any reason? It's amazing. Dr. Sheff, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue our conversation with Dr. Elizabeth Sheff author of Stories from the Polycule, Real Life in Polyamorous Families. We'll be right back. What brought you to your own interest in writing about polyamorous families?
When I was 22, I fell in love with someone who wanted non-monogamy, and it terrified me. And as an intellectual, I intellectualized things that frightened me. So I had been an undergraduate when I met this man, and then we stayed together we were together for 15 years, in fact. And through our explorations of me trying to figure out how to manage my fear, I found the polyamorous community first as a civilian, meaning not as a researcher, and ultimately started researching it. While I have found that polyamory doesn't really work for me, it does work great for some people.
So in that situation, it's interesting because he was interested in a polyamorous relationship and you were not, and yet you were with each other for 15 years. I would think that would have been a challenging 15 years.
It was, definitely. And if I had been madly in love with him, I would have run away from him, definitely. But I was just so incredibly smitten with him that I was willing to do anything to keep that relationship. And in retrospect, I wish I hadn't been so willing to compromise my own boundaries around that. But it was an incredibly rich and painful learning experience for me. And the irony of that is we were hardly polyamorous at all. I would say for 14 of our 15 years, we were monogamous and talking about polyamory, or polyamorous in theory rather than practice. The short time that we actually were trying to date other people paled in comparison to all the time that we spent talking about it and negotiating it and thinking about it and talking to other people about it.
It's interesting that so much of your time was spent on sort of analyzing the possibilities rather than in engaging in the actuality. What caused the breakup? I mean, 15 years is a long time.
It is. He wanted to be with another woman. He had wanted me to find us a woman to add into our relationship. And I was really reluctant. So I kind of came up, you had asked at one point, what are the rules?
Yes.
For polyamorous relationships? So I came up with all sorts of outlandish rules to manipulate the situation so that he could be polyamorous in his own mind, but we would never actually find someone to be polyamorous with. But unfortunately, that led to endless negotiations about how about we tweak the rule this way? How about we tweak the rule that way? Until finally I was like, okay, fine. Just go out and date. I'm taking all the rules off. Just go do your thing, whatever. And he found that it wasn't as easy to date. He had kind of anticipated a flood of opportunity and realized that there wasn't as much opportunity. And when I originally was thinking that we were going to be, when I was like, okay, let's just take off the rules, thinking that we would be in a poly-mono relationship, meaning that he would date and I would not, that, you know, it was open that I could date, but I just wasn't interested in it. And then I met a man who was very interested in me, and I fell in love with him as well, and my partner at the time couldn't deal with it. He was the one who had pushed for polyamory, but then was like, oh, wait a minute, it's a man instead of a woman? I don't want to do this.
Be careful what you ask for, huh?
Exactly. And I was irate, to put it mildly. I don't know if you can be mildly irate, but I was furious. And tried for 5 years to get over it. At that time, we had two small children. We had a one-year-old and a three-year-old. And if we didn't have those kids, I would have left him the instant he said, I don't want to do this anymore, let's be monogamous. Because he had pushed for it for 10 years when it was going to be another woman. But as soon as it was going to be a man for me, he didn't want to do it anymore. Oh, I'm getting angry just thinking about it again right now. But because we had these two small children, and we had had, there had been lots of good things in our relationship too, I tried to get over it and agreed to not date this man that I had fallen in love with. And in fact, we moved to a different state.
Oh my, he was
serious. To try to start over again.
Yeah, okay.
And I just couldn't. 5 years later, I came home from work one day and thought to myself, ugh, I need a drink if I'm going to deal with this man. And that scared me. I was like, wait a minute, did I just say to myself, I need a drink? That's not going to work. So it became clear to me that the choice was going to be stay with him and become an alcoholic or leave him. And I chose the latter. And that was the right move.
I was going to say, it sounds like that was the healthier choice for you.
And for my children. And I was very angry at him still. I kept trying everything I could think of to get over it. We got couples counseling, which was actually pretty helpful and effective. I got personal counseling. I tried aromatherapy and hypnotherapy. And once it was clear that I was going to have to move on to sedation, I thought, this is not going to work.
And what about today as we speak? How's your relationship life today?
Today I'm in an excellent relationship. My wife and I are monogamish in that we allow each other to hook up with other people if we want to, but we don't. I mean, that possibility is there for us. We just don't act on it. We have had little flings in our relationship together and with others, but we're just not. I mean, we're pretty busy, for one thing, and it's time-consuming to date and maintain multiple relationships. And for me, my sex drive is not that high. So I'm not necessarily that driven to find sexual variety.
Mm-hmm.
When I am feeling sexually desirous, I want to kind of point that at her. I, again, feel almost like a poly-mono relationship would work better for us. She has a higher sex drive, and I think if we could find her a girlfriend that I liked, I would feel less guilty about not having more sex with her if she had other sexual outlets. I actually get a lot of my emotional needs met through friendship. So I feel like I don't necessarily need multiple lovers, but I get a lot of intimacy, emotional intimacy, and affection from my friends. I have fabulous friends, I have to say, and that kind of fulfills that need for me. Not to say that I am permanently closed off to the possibility that I might have another fling with someone, but sometimes I just feel tired when I think about it, just because my relationship with my wife is very fulfilling and satisfying, and I am busy, as you pointed out before. So the idea of trying to find someone else to date, sometimes I would just rather go to sleep.
Okie dokie. Let me ask you this. You know, it's good to hear that you have been through, as I think has everyone, been through your own relationship challenges, but come out on the other side, and now you are in a relationship that really feeds you, and it sounds like feeds you well, and that is a good thing for you and for your wife. Let me ask you this, we're clearly not saying that any one relationship style or choice, or however one defines it, is better than another. But for those who are interested in working with clinicians, for example, or getting more information about polyamorous relationships, are there any resources you can point folks to?
Yes. I have a blog on Psychology Today called The Polyamorists Next Door.
Okay.
And, in fact, I'm about my blog that's up right now. My most recent blog is on jealousy, but the one that comes out next is on finding resources. The first part of it is about therapeutic bias against non-monogamy, which is unfortunately extremely common among mental health practitioners.
Indeed.
And the second part of that is how to both combat therapeutic bias and finding a therapist who is aware of and knowledgeable about consensual non-monogamy. So there's a few different resources. One of them is Kink Aware Professionals. And that is a listing, it's a directory on the National Coalition for Sexual Freedom, NCSF.org, has the Kink Aware Professionals. And while polyamory and kink are not the same thing, generally, if someone is knowledgeable in one, they are knowledgeable in the other.
I see.
As well. Also, Loving More is an organization that has conferences and a magazine, and they have a website, lovemore.com, and there's a list of poly professionals there as well that covers the U.S. and I think parts of Canada and Mexico, possibly Puerto Rico.
Okay.
So there definitely are resources if you look around online.
And if someone wants to take a look at your blog, how specifically does one get to it? Just by going to Psychology Today?
Or you can also, that's where I host my shorter blogs. I have longer one more academic, but also more, you can't just post anything on psychology today. It has to be kind of neutral and science-oriented. So if it's a more opinion-oriented piece or something like that, I'll post it on my own blog,
okay,
which is elisabethshef.com.
And can you spell that for me?
ELISABETHSHEF.com. And I also provide relationship consultations, either one-time consultations for people with a specific issue around polyamory or BDSM, or ongoing relationship coaching. But I'm not a therapist. I'm a certified sexuality educator.
Okay. And again, the your website is it Dr. Elisabeth or Elisabeth?
Just Elisabeth, yes. I'm a PhD in sociology.
Okay.
But I don't, that's not in that website address.
Okay.
ElisabethSchef.com.
All right. And again, that's ElisabethSchef.com.
Yes. So it's Elisabeth with an S instead of a Z.
Gotcha.
Yes.
Thank you very much for spending time with us today and
educating
us.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. My pleasure. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. And the website, remember, it's myndtalk.org. You can listen to today's program and any program you choose on demand by going to myndtalk.org. And folks, remember, if it's unacceptable, then that's what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.